cultural culture of temples and icons in China.
Thank you, Chris. No, yes, after the brief sort of diversion of Boga with Jack, this is a panel on asceticism and yoga, and we don't want you to get too enthralled with those visual things and sort of get distracted and taken astray. So these are three talks that are very much non-visual. Also, and more realistically, I wanted to kind of leave time for conversation, and the visuals, I thought, would take too much of the time. I would like to, before I start, however, thank, on the one hand, we have our sort of Gyanakonda of, where's Gavin, I saw, and Himanshu, and various other, Patrick, who organized this panel. We also have the Karmakonda group of Shaunika and Jessica, I think, stepped out. And we have a whole lot of people to thank for bringing us together here. And as I was saying to some of them this morning, a conference works better the more work that has been done in advance. In other words, a smooth working conference, you don't realize all the work that was gone because it's gone so smoothly. So we all owe them a great vote of thanks in that way. I'm not actually going to present my paper. I'm going to follow Jack's model a little bit and talk around it. This is sort of the, I hope that many of you had a chance to read the all-too-long version that was on the web. This is sort of the Sankshipt oral version, perhaps so Sankshipt that it's a rahasya, but we can, I hope, not have that problem. But, I mean, this is a paper that is on a panel that was organized by Patrick, and he asked me to do this, a panel with the one exception of bhakti on asceticism. And sort of the notion, again, as Chris said in the introduction, that sort of ascetics and temple worshippers are in some kind of a tension or contradiction. And certainly that is there in the tradition. However, I'm going to take advantage of the opportunity given me by Patrick to argue, in fact, that this is the wrong place to put Jainism in many ways, that to view it only as an ascetic tradition is a profound overreading of one part of the tradition, and that there's a whole lot else going on in the religious tradition that overreading doesn't allow us to see. That in fact, if we start with what I call, borrowing from the art historian Margaret Miles, the evidence of the eyes, as I talked a little bit in the written version of my paper, I mean, there are more Jain icons in the world today than there are Jain people, by a factor of many times. Several years ago, I heard somebody estimate that there are at least 50,000 Jain temples in India for a population of maybe 5 or 6 million people. In fact, there's so many temples, many of them don't have anybody to worship in them, and it's a huge logistical problem. And yet more temples are built all the time, more icons are consecrated all the time. The population of temples and icons is increasing far faster than the population of people. And if you go to India, or for that matter you go to Leicester, or in my country you go to northern New Jersey, you're not going to meet Jain ascetics. You're going to meet Jain temples and Jain icons. And so for most of us, that, in fact, is our exposure to the tradition. Yet oftentimes we ignore that and say, well, it's really all about asceticism and ahimsa and vairagya and tapasya and all of those things, and sort of leave out the material evidence of the tradition there. And that certainly is something I came into my study with. And in fact, it's an understanding of the tradition as basically, essentially, if I can use that old term, a tradition of asceticism is a long-standing trope in academic discourse. And I give a quotation in the paper I'll give you here by Hermann Jacobi, in many ways sort of the key founding figure for Jain studies in the West, highly worshipped or venerated in India, also honored in India, very pujaniya because of his work, given various awards by the Jain community. And in his introduction to his first volume of translations in the Sacred Books of the East, which sort of brings us back to Oxford and Max Müller there, he writes about image worship in temples, quote, "This worship had nothing to do with the original Jainism. It did not originate with the monks, but with the lay community. When the people in general felt the want of a higher cult than that of their rude deities and demons, the Jains were brought to adopt this practice by the perpetual and irresistible influence of the religious development of the people in India." Greg Chopin has talked a lot about the similar parallel understanding of Buddhism as a tradition that was really a monastic tradition, but the monks had to compromise themselves and sort of deal with these, you know, vulgar practices of the ignorant lay people who wanted temples and icons and things like that. Similar model is there for the understanding of Jainism. However, I don't think it bears up to scrutiny there. That monks have been essential for the cult of icons, have been essential for the cult of icons for about two millennia. That there's a little bit of textual evidence that predates the presence of icons in temples in the Jain tradition, but very, very little. And it's written by world-renouncing monks. And so that Patrick has very importantly reminded us, we have to say, who's authoring these texts? And we have to make sure we don't give undue priority to texts that are written from a certain ideological perspective. But the evidence of Mathura, which has come up various other times, and the Jain evidence there is older than that of, a little bit older than some of the Buddhist and older than some of the other materials, we can push back to about the second century before the Common Era, very clearly indicates icons and temples. I'll come to that at the end there. But one could argue that, okay, in the contemporary practice, monks are involved with temples in a variety of ways. But let's look at some of the ways they are involved. And I tell the story, and I'll just sort of briefly summarize it here, of the Temple of Ossian that I've studied for a number of years in western India, outside of Jodhpur, that a temple that was abandoned largely by the Jains and was rediscovered by several Jain monks in a period of decades over the late 19th, early 20th century. And in fact, it was these Jain monks who got it out of the hands of the Hindu pujaris, the Bojiks, back into the hands of Jain trusts. Then the trusts weren't being very well maintained, and so one of these monks, Gyan Sundarji, sort of sat down and instructed the lay Munim, who was supposedly looking after the temple. He says, this isn't any good. You've got to keep accounts. You've got to have account books. You've got to make sure where all the money's coming from, where it's going to. You know, you've got to organize this in a good fashion. So here was a monk very much involved in these sort of in the maintenance of a temple. But it was also in a town where no Jains could live, or no Jains did live, and there was supposedly a curse against Jains living there. And he was worried about, he says, if you have a temple with no community, you're not going to have the temple survive. So what's he do? He establishes a boarding school, which today is still going very well, to ensure a presence of Jains in the town. And as one of the requirements, all the Jain boys in the school had to go worship at the temple. So he educates them, but also maintains the temple. And this is a monk who is doing all of these things. And his role in the maintenance of this temple is absolutely crucial. Now, you could say, okay, fine. 20th century, we have monks in temples. That doesn't say anything earlier than the 20th century. But there's a number of medieval texts which also lay out this connection. I talk in brief about one from the early 14th century, referring to events in around 1315, after the desecration of the temples in Chetrinjay and some damage, we don't know exactly what, to the temples and the icons there. And there was a sense that this Jirnodara that I referred to yesterday had to occur. The temples needed to be restored. And it is done jointly by the two laymen, father and son, Deshil Shah and Samar Shah, who've got the money to do it. You know, it takes money, as Jack said, to build temples and consecrate icons. But you also needed the monks. And so Siddhasuri is the one who actually goes and performs the ritual to reconsecrate the temple, reconsecrate the icons. And it's a joint activity there. Without the two of them together, you're not going to have these temples restored. So that's two bits of evidence I give. One of monks who are sort of encouraging lay people in the present to build, to restore, to renovate temples. There is also an historical precedent for this going back at least till about 1,000 years or so. But there are other ways also in which the cult of icons and temples depends upon the monks. And here I discuss in much greater length in the paper this ritual known as Anjana Shalaka. I'll sort of briefly touch it here. It's the eye-opening of a Jina icon, which cannot be done in the Jain context, or in the Shvetambara Jain context, I have to be specific, I'm not sure about the Digambara, by a lay person. Only an Acharya, who is the highest renouncer in the Jain tradition, can actually enliven the icon. And there's a special ritual that he does, usually in the middle of the night. He has the shalaka is a golden stick, and he utters various mantras, and he rubs it across the eye, and it goes from being inert stone to being a live jinnah icon. Without the acharya doing that, you don't have an icon that can be worshipped by lay people. So the world-renouncing ascetic is essential for the enlivening of the icon. Without him, it doesn't happen. Again, you could say, well, okay, here we have cases where, as a matter of pragmatism, the monks are doing things for the lay people that they can't do themselves or don't want to do themselves, but isn't there some kind of ascetic, non-icon core of the tradition that has nothing to do with this, where true monasticism occurs? No, is the short answer. And here what I do is I give you the texts in the written version. The ritual that is known as Chaitya Vandana. Chaitya in the Jain context, there are some people in the last 500 years, as Peter Flugel here will explain to you, who've denied or disputed this reading. But it's fairly clear that the reading of the word Chaitya in the Jain tradition for the last 2,000 years has been as an icon. It is synonymous with Bimba, with Pratima, with Murti. So a different meaning for the term than we find in the Buddhist context. That's a whole other discussion and paper we can have some other day. But Chaitya Vandana, the veneration of the Chaitya, is one of the six essential duties, these avashyakas, that are incumbent upon every single Jain mendicant. This is both Shvetambar and Digambar. The text has significant overlaps, and so as I discussed in an article I published a couple of years ago, because of the fact that there's the same text found largely in Shvetambar and Digambar contexts, I would say this is a text, a liturgy, that we can push safely back 1,800, 2,000 years before the sort of sectarian solidification within the Jain tradition. And at three places in this veneration that is done by monks at least twice a day and by many of them more often, they very explicitly say, I bow down to the icons. Wherever the icons are located, I bow down to them. And so an essential ritual activity of monks is venerating icons. If the monk ceases to venerate the icons, he in fact is not being a good monk. So in that way, the two are connected. The last bit, and I want to leave time for conversation, and I also realize that I'm the only thing standing between you and lunch, so I don't want to go on too long, is evidence. And again, we've raised the issue of Mathura a number of times here, because it is some of the earliest evidence from sort of the main subcontinent. There's the Gandharan material, but it sort of is raises its own set of problems. But within the subcontinent, Mathura is sort of, for archaeologists, the lodestone of icons and temples, and also because of all the inscriptions. It's a very rich source for us. The largest number of icons, actually there are many more Jain icons than there are Buddhist icons in Mathura, even though it tends to be discussed in Buddhist context, not Jain context. The Jain icons slightly predate the Buddhist icons, although I'm not sure that that's a strong argument, because all we need is one new Buddhist icon with an earlier date and that argument goes out. But it was clearly a very important Buddhist Jain site and a Buddhist site. And as Greg Chopin has shown in the Buddhist context, this was not a lay cult of icons to which the monks sort of begrudgingly cooperated. In fact, the monks were very much involved with the manufacture, the consecration, the worship of the icons. The language is a little bit different with the Jains. The Jain monks seem to have had maybe half a step, sort of 6 inches away from what the Buddhist monks were doing. They don't actually commission the icons themselves directly by their own work, but the inscriptions, and there's a large number of these, the language is that the icons were installed, is I guess the best way to translate pratishtapita, by a lay person, a lay man or a lay woman, but almost inevitably is also at the preaching, at the urging, at the encouragement of a monk or a nun. Mathura, we have a much differently gendered Jain tradition. So the monks and nuns were not themselves actually arranging for the icons by their own action, but they were causing the icons to be made by preaching to the lay people. And the language is all over the inscriptions there. So these four things I bring forward of monks who are actively engaged in preaching to lay people that they need to maintain the cult of icons in temples, both present and medieval, the role of the monks in the opening of the eye of the icon, the monks on their own, whether or not there are any lay people doing the Chaitya Vandana, the veneration, and then the evidence from Mathura, clearly indicate that we have a long-standing role of ascetics or mendicants, renouncers, and icons. So I want to just read then a little bit of my conclusion, and then I'll give us 10 minutes for discussion. With two suggestions as to what the long-standing, close involvement of monks with icons might signify for a better understanding of Jainism, mendicants, and icons. And I would argue that this actually is applicable much more broadly. I think that many of the issues that Professor Rukmani were dealing with, my evidence kind of goes some way to answering that. And I'm here again thinking about Patrick's very important comment that we always have to say, who wrote these texts? What was the context within which they wrote them? And that other evidence may give us a fuller picture of what people were doing. On the one hand, the material I present necessitates us rethinking what exactly is meant by world renunciation or asceticism, as it was in the title of the panel. While texts can be found in all the renouncer traditions that valorize radical world renunciation, this in fact is not a fully accurate picture of on-the-ground renunciation. And here I think that the old model of Louis Dumont of the world renouncer versus the man in the world is highly problematic and very misleading and sort of stems from his own kind of European romantic tradition more than on-the-ground Indology. Most renouncers at most times and in most places have lived lives that were much more interactive with worldly lay practicalities. In the Jain case, the renouncer is not a solitary seeker, and in fact, monastic codes indicate he should not be alone. While the act of renunciation involves him giving up much, it is equally an initiatory rebirth into a new socialized existence as an institutional and routinized renouncer. Jain monks are expected to have a different relationship with the material world than householders, but they do indeed have a relationship with it. At the heart of this relationship is their relationship with the highly tangible materiality of icons and temples. Now, many summaries or brief introductions to Jainism presented as a religious tradition focused upon asceticism. This certainly is an important aspect of the tradition. I'm not trying to, say, get rid of that. And it has been since its earliest levels. And the monks, by their vows and their practices, certainly are ascetics. What I propose, however, and this is the second conclusion to my paper, is that we see Jainism equally as a religious tradition focused upon icons and therefore temples. While those who encounter Jainism through books, especially survey textbooks, first experience it in terms of asceticism and nonviolence, those, as I indicated before, who encounter Jainism on the ground in India, in the UK, in Antwerp, in North America, experience it primarily and originally as in terms of temples and icons. So it is a path of temples, a path of icons, as much as it is anything else. And we've got 10 minutes, and sort of I'm hoping we can have comments, queries, and these can bounce off of earlier papers, et cetera. One and two. Who wants you?
Yes, thank you. That was great. My first question is that if one sees archaeologically, I'm talking about the early period, say pre-7th century, there seem to be more icons than temples. And is that only a question? I'm looking at Mathura, I'm also looking at Gujarat. There seem to be more bronzes, more images, rather than actual temples. Now that could be, that could partly be a problem of survey and, the sort of that.
Right.
But is it only that? And do we get monks actually giving icons?
No. We do not find monks themselves giving the icons. Rather than the active form of the verb, it's the causative form of the verb.
That's in the inscriptions.
Yes.
On the icons.
Yes, They're very, very much so. The monks will do the consecration, but then the actual, all the other stuff is done by the lay people. And the language of the inscriptions is remarkably consistent over millennia in the Jain tradition. Now, your question is certainly a good one. I mean, now at Mathura, the archaeological evidence is we have several hundred icons. We have these Ayyappa puttas, which we don't know exactly how, were they horizontal, were they vertical, were they placed around trees, were they placed against the walls of the stupa, were they, you know, we really don't know how the Ayaga puttas were used. There is inscriptional reference to a Jain temple in Mathura, and so perhaps the icons were used there. But this was sort of behind my question of Patrick, of, you know, icons and temples, we don't, you know, don't necessarily go hand in hand. And there certainly is a long-standing Jain tradition of sort of household altars and household worship of icons. However, many of the ones at Mathura, I mean, these are big. You're not going to put it in your living room. You know? I mean, it's just, it's too big to do that. You don't have the, you don't have small bronzes at Mathura, so it is a public cult, not a private cult. Western India is a good question, because we have bronze icons from 5th, 6th century, and the earliest extant temple is 8th century up at Ossian. And in between there, what was happening? That is a very good question. And I will take your model of saying, it's a wonderful question, I don't have an answer for that one. I wish I did. But it's one I need to sort of think about more.
I'm totally baffled. One of the three or four things I thought I knew about Jainism was that the tradition was riven for centuries by the quarrels between the Murti Pujakas and their opponents. Is that completely wrong?
No, it is not. But very few centuries. Only four or five.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
Okay, it's quite a lot. But the very fact that they're riven by a conflict over icons and temples would in some ways indicate the centrality of icons and temples. And the fact that this is an argument that has continued for five centuries indicates that nobody won, and therefore these are worth continuing to fight about generation after generation.
But what were the arguments of the people who said that Murti Puja was wrong in Jainism?
You know, actually, at this point, we can have another paper by Peter Flugel, who is the world expert on the Sthanikvasis and the Terapantis. It's a complex set of arguments, some of them historical, saying that, you know, this very early, and actually, it's interesting, in the 20th century, they actually, the evidence comes from the archaeological survey and the Indologists and Jacobi, that the argument material then gets filtered back into the Jain arguments that the earliest tradition did not have icons, therefore, in truth, it's not an iconic tradition. You do have this distinction in the Jain tradition, and I talk about it more in the written version, between Dravya and Bhava, between physical stuff and spiritual. And even within the image-worshipping tradition, it is a very active tension, and many people will give precedence to Bhava. It also goes back to Jain ontology, where in its ultimate state, the soul is pure spirit and is devoid, is completely separated all contacts with Dravya, with physical stuff, with Putkala. So, I mean, there are a number of sources there. And I'm finishing a book right now that argues that actually there's been disquiet about icons for almost as long as there have been icons. That many of the strategies to defend icons that we find in the early years or middle years of the first millennium, you don't defend icons unless somebody else, and we don't know who they are, is criticizing them.
Yeah.
So this is a long-standing tension, and I'm not trying to deny that, but I'm saying that if we basically privilege the ascetics over all the icons, we are in fact engaged in an internal theological argument rather than an external historical scholarly argument. But we can't privilege one or the other, and what our goal is to see the way in which this tension has articulated itself for two millennia. So is that?
Yes, just to restore a little balance, because you didn't mention them.
Yes.
With the historically prominent role of monastics in image production, whether that be through encouragement or religious instruction, etc., can you say a few words on why the rise of the Yetis in the 19th century? And they're sort of, they start kind of really taking over.
Oh, this is, yes, for those of you who aren't knowledgeable about Jainism, actually for the last 1,000 years there's been another tension between domesticated, resident, quasi-renouncers, you know, who can live in a place, handle money. In fact, in many parts of India, in some parts of India, they then became married. They certainly had children and did a lot of things that renouncers aren't supposed to be doing. As opposed to sort of the full-fledged monastics who maintained the five vows.
And they were involved with image production too, as well, right? In temple worship?
They were, but they were no less involved than were the full-fledged monks. That's
so
I think
their rise probably isn't connected with that. I thought maybe they took over more of the temple activity.
The rise of the domesticated monks is vastly predates these disputes, medieval disputes. I mean, it really stems back about 1,000 years in the two traditions in that way. And my evidence here is all Shvetambara. I mean, there's Digamber material that I haven't investigated yet, so I can't help you with your temple there.
The same problem a little bit with what you're saying, but I actually talked with Gregory Schoenfeld. He's surely right about what he says about things in the first millennium AD, but we always knew that. It's not new. So the question I have for you is, what about the 4th century BC?
Our evidence for the 4th century BC in terms of the Jains is zero. Zero. There are texts that we can probably date to the 2nd century BC. And those earliest texts indeed make no reference to icons or temples. However, within a century of those, we find icons and temples, the archaeological evidence. And this is where sort of the source of our materials, and I like to sort of, you know, we have to do a genre analysis. Who is writing? What are they writing? For whom are they writing? And these early texts were very much sort of similar to a lot of the early Buddhist texts, similar to a lot of the early sort of more renunciatory Hindu texts, and in their own ways, very similar to the kind of Brahmanical texts that Patrick was talking about. You know, kind of trying to lay out a very strictly delimited world and saying, this is what we do, and sort of what are the rules for this. And we make a mistake if we try and read a broad social history out of these texts that are written for very specific communities and contexts. I do think that we can argue that the development of icons and temples in all three of these traditions, you're talking about Vedic Brahmanical tradition, the Buddhist tradition, and the Jain tradition, is not a development we can push back to the founder or, you know, sort of the, whenever these, what would be an equivalent time, you know, 5th, 6th century BCE in the Brahmanical tradition. I mean, it is a later development, there's no doubt about that. But not all that much later in that way. I think that's an important thing. And I don't think it was a case in any of the three traditions that there was widespread wholesale opposition to it. There was opposition in certain places. I mean, again, Patrick's paper very well spells out some people who, for a variety of reasons, liturgical reasons, theological reasons, and I'm sure economic reasons, and social reasons too. Because certainly in the last 1,000 years, you know, the Puchikas that Devangana talked about and sort of Shrotriya Brahmins, you know, they certainly don't, they meet together, they don't marry together, they don't talk to each other, and in fact, from the Vedic perspective, these other guys aren't Brahmins. You know, let's not confuse ourselves here. You know, so there are a whole lot of factors there that are going on that we have to take into account.
So we have time for one more question, and it's Professor Rukmini, and then there's a couple of things we have to do before we disperse.
Okay.
Mine is really, I think my question may not be answered because I got the impression towards the end that you're only talking about the Shvetambaras and not the Digambaras.
My evidence is largely Shvetambara. Huh.
But when you talk about a Jaina tradition, isn't it wise or isn't it prudent to, because the Digambaras are definitely predating the Shvetambaras, wouldn't it be also proper to look at both of them, and then is it the tradition the same in the Digambara tradition as well as in the Shvetambara? This is what
there are certain details I cannot answer that. I haven't done the detailed work on texts and inscriptions in the Digambara tradition that I have on the Shvetambara tradition. You also have a different tradition in that you had landed semi-monastic, these Bhattatakas who really take over the Digambara tradition for the last 1,000 years. I mean, the Digambara Muni, as we now think of it, is really a 20th century reinvention. And so I'm not sure what was happening in the medieval period. Mathura predates the split quite clearly in that way. But the inscriptional evidence I have looked at, especially from South India, indicates that these mendicants and the householders were tied together. But the fact is that full-fledged Digamber monasticism, we don't know exactly how long it was. It was a dead institution before it was reinvented. I mean, but for many centuries, there were no, I shouldn't say no, but the few full-fledged Digamber monks they were really freelance sort of old guys who sort of got some vairagya and took their clothes off in a temple and wandered around and had nothing to do with anything else. But they weren't even monks in a full-fledged sense of the word. So, I mean, the Digamber tradition is really murky in terms of the medieval history of it. So that's why I said my evidence is more on the Shvetamber side. But then when we reemerge into history in the first millennium, we find the inscriptional evidence on the Digamber side very parallel to that of the Shvetamber side.
Well, all right. So we have really two things that we have to accomplish. And the second of them